Okay, so picture a crime scene. But we aren't talking about yellow tape on a street corner.
No chalk outline on a sidewalk.
This crime scene is microscopic. It's happening deep inside a piece of steel. And we have a major problem. Our two best witnesses, these high-tech scientific instruments, are telling two completely different stories.
And in the world of material science, you know, when your witnesses don't agree, you can't just throw the case out. You have to dig into the physics,
Right.
the fundamental laws of nature, really, to figure out which machine is, well, which one is lying to you.
Or maybe if they're both telling the truth and we're just hearing it wrong. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today, we're opening a cold case from 1982.
We have a paper by Hall, Padeshia, and Stobbs from the University of Cambridge. It's got a heavy title, The Incomplete Bainite Reaction: Possible Reasons for the Apparent Differences in TEM and Atom Probe Determination of Austenite Carbon Content.
It sounds dense, I know, it really does. But if you strip away the jargon, this paper is. It's a fantastic detective story. It's about how steel transforms, and it involves a really deep mathematical investigation to clear the name of a very important suspect.
And before you tune out because you don't smelt iron in your backyard, this matters. I mean, this is the science that dictates whether the steel in a bridge holds up or buckles.
Or how safe your car chassis is. It's all about how we make materials stronger. But to get there, we first have to solve this mystery of the incomplete reaction.
Right. And the central character here, the victim, maybe, or the protagonist, is bainite.
Bainite, yeah.
So let's set the stage. We've got steel. It's hot. It's in a phase called austenite.
You can think of austenite as the blank slate of steel. It's a high-temperature structure, iron and carbon, all mixed together in a face-centered cubic lattice.
Okay.
But as you cool it down, it becomes unstable. It wants to transform into something else. In this case, it wants to become bainite.
And this is where the big controversy was back in the early 80s. The debate wasn't about what it became, but how it happens.
Exactly. There were two main camps in metallurgy. You had Camp A, who believed in diffusion.
Okay.
They thought carbon atoms just slowly wandered around, migrating comfortably until the metal reached a chemical balance, you know, a relaxed state where everything's happy.
Like a crowd just slowly dispersing from a room, very orderly.
Sure. But then you had Camp B, where our authors Padeshia and Stobbs were, and they believed in shear.
Sure.
They argued that bainite forms violently. The crystal structure literally snaps into a new shape instantly.
Oh, wow.
And it traps the carbon atoms before they even have a chance to move.
So like a military formation snapping to attention. No wandering allowed.
Precisely. And here is the key. If Camp B is right, if it's a sheer transformation, the reaction has to stop abruptly.
It can't go all the way.
It can't go all the way to that comfortable chemical balance. It should freeze at a specific energy limit we call the T0 curve.
Because that snap creates so much strain energy that the reaction just chokes itself off.
That's the incomplete reaction. The transformation stops before it theoretically should, and it leaves a lot of untransformed austenite behind.
And the carbon content in that leftover austenite is the smoking gun.
That's the smoking gun.
Okay, I follow. So to prove who is right, Camp Diffusion or Camp Shear, you just need to measure the carbon left in that austenite. If the carbon hits that specific T0 limit and stops, Camp Shear wins.
Simple, right. But here's where the investigation just goes completely off the rails. They had two ways to measure that carbon. Witness number one, the atom probe.
This is the direct method.
Extremely direct.
Yeah.
The atom probe is a fascinating instrument. It uses a high electric field to rip atoms off the sample one by one.
One by one.
And it identifies them. Your iron, your carbon, your nickel. It's like taking a census.
And what did the census say?
Well, the atom probe results were, they were perfect. They showed the carbon content clustering right around that T0 limit.
Exactly what the shear theory predicted.
Exactly.
So case closed. The shear theory works. Why are we even here?
Because of witness number two. The transmission electron microscope, or TEM.
The indirect method.
Right. Here you aren't counting atoms. You're looking at pictures of the crystal lattice.
Specifically, you're measuring the spacing between the rows of atoms, the lattice fringes.
Correct. Carbon atoms are like little wedges. If you shove them into the iron lattice, they push the iron atoms apart. The lattice expands. So if you measure that spacing, you can calculate how much carbon is wedged in there.
It's sort of like looking at a brick wall and trying to figure out how thick the mortar is by measuring the total height of the wall.
That's a good analogy. And this is where things went wrong. The TEM data just didn't match the atom probe.
Was it just a little off?
It was chaos. Absolute scatter. Some readings matched the atom probe,
okay,
but others were way, way too low. And the most damning evidence, Some readings were impossibly high.
How impossible are we talking?
We're talking higher than the equilibrium line. Thermodynamically illegal.
Wow.
It's like a witness claiming they saw a car driving 500 miles per hour on a city street. It just shouldn't be physically possible for steel to hold that much carbon.
So if the TEM data is real, then the whole incomplete reaction theory just, it falls apart.
It does. It implies something totally different is happening, or that our entire understanding is fundamentally broken.
Okay.
So Hall, Padishia, and Stobbs decide they need to clear this up. They pick a specific steel alloy to test high silicon, high nickel.
And why that specific recipe?
The silicon is the key. Silicon acts as a preservative. Usually when steel cools, carbon tries to precipitate out as cementite iron carbide.
Right.
But silicon stops that. It acts as a barrier. It keeps the crime scene clean, so we're only looking at carbon dissolved in the austenite.
Okay, so they have their clean sample. They have the conflicting witnesses. Now they start interrogating the suspects to explain the TEM's crazy numbers. Suspect number one, the ruler.
This is a classic scientific sanity check. To measure the spacing in the austenite, the TEM uses the neighboring ferrite, the iron part, as a reference scale.
So it's assuming the ferrite is a standard size.
A standard brick size, yes. Yeah. But if the ferrite has carbon in it, that brick would be swollen, and your ruler would be wrong.
And if your ruler is wrong, your measurement is wrong.
Exactly. And the Atom probe did show that ferrite sometimes holds extra carbon, specifically around defects called dislocations.
So the ruler was broken?
Well, probably not. The authors argue that when you take a high-resolution TEM picture, you intentionally pick the cleanest, most perfect spot you can find.
You're not looking at the defects.
You avoid the defects. You avoid the dislocations. So in the areas they measured, the ferrite was likely pure iron. The ruler was fine.
Okay. Suspect one is cleared. What about suspect two, the invisible accomplice?
Right.
Could there be tiny invisible carbides hiding in the metal foil, messing everything up?
It's a valid concern. If there's a little cluster of carbon, a nucleus of a carbide, hidden inside the thickness of the foil, it might skew the results.
So did they find any?
They hunted for them. They scanned foil after foil, looking for these phantom carbides. And they found one.
One single carbide.
Just one. In all of their examinations, it's definitely not enough to explain the massive scatter they were seeing.
So not a gang of invisible carbides sabotaging the data. Which brings us to the prime suspect.
Elastic strain.
This is the physics heavyweight.
It is. The logic goes like this. When austenite turns into bainite, there's a volume change. The bainite takes up more space. It expands.
Like ice freezing in a pipe.
Exactly. So that expansion has to push against the surrounding austenite. It squeezes it.
Okay.
It creates a massive stress field.
And now, remember how the TEM measures carbon?
By measuring the spacing between atoms.
Right. So if I physically squeeze a crystal, the atoms get pushed closer together. The spacing changes.
And the TEM, which is just a machine that measures distance, sees that change and thinks, oh, the carbon content is changing.
Bingo. They hypothesized that the metal was under so much mechanical stress, so much elastic strain, that it was faking the chemical data.
The squeeze was mimicking the effect of chemistry.
It's a really elegant theory. It explains why the Atom probe, which counts atoms, was right, and the TEM, which measures spacing, was wrong.
The TEM was being tricked by the pressure, so to prove it, they had to do some serious math. They turned to a legendary framework in mechanics developed by J.D. Eshelby.
The Eshelby inclusion theory.
It sounds like a spy novel title, doesn't it? But essentially, Eshelby gave us the math to calculate what happens when you shove a foreign object, an inclusion, inside a solid material.
And in this case, the intruder is the bainite plate growing inside the steel.
Correct. They modeled the bainite as an oblate spheroid. So think of a penny or maybe a lens shape. Very wide, but very thin.
And they wanted to see if the strain around that penny was enough to distort the lattice.
Yeah, and they assumed the worst case scenario. An invariant plane strain transformation, which creates the maximum possible mismatch. They calculated the strain perpendicular to the disk and parallel to it.
Okay, we don't need to solve the equations here. What was this verdict? Was the squeeze happening?
Well, initially, yes. If you assume the metal is just a solid, infinite block of steel, the calculations showed the strains were pretty significant.
So the theory holds.
Wait for it. Because this is where the specific conditions of the experiment matter. TEM isn't done on a solid block of steel.
Right, it's done on a foil.
A tiny, incredibly thin shaving of metal. I mean, these samples are transparent to electrons, and that changes the physics entirely.
Because there's no back wall to push against.
Exactly. This is the thin foil effect. Because the sample is so thin, the stress just, it relaxes. The metal can just bulge out at the surface. The pressure dissipates.
The squeeze disappears.
Most of it, yeah. When they ran the Eshelby calculations specifically for the geometry of thin foil, they found that the error caused by any remaining strain dropped to almost nothing.
Give me a number. How big was the error?
We're talking about an error of less than 0.01 weight percent carbon.
That is negligible.
Completely. I mean, remember, the scatter they were seeing in the TEM data was massive. Variations of 0.5% or more. The strain only accounts for 0.01.
Even if the foil was bent or something.
Even then, they calculated that random bending might give you an error of maybe 0.1%, absolute most.
But nowhere near enough to explain the wild data.
Not even close.
So the prime suspect is innocent. Elastic strain is not tricking the TEM.
That's the verdict. The physics of elastic strain cannot explain the discrepancy.
It brings us right back to square one. The ruler is fine. There are no invisible carbides. The strain isn't high enough. So why on earth did the TEM show those crazy, impossible carbon numbers?
The car going 500 miles an hour.
Right. Why did the machine say there was way too much carbon?
The authors conclude that the car really was going 500 miles an hour.
What?
Just for a split second, in a very specific spot.
You mean the high carbon readings?
Yeah.
They were real.
They were real, but they were local. This is the big twist. It all comes down to sampling bias.
Break that down for me. How does a microscope have bias?
Okay, think about how you take a TEM picture. To see those lattice fringes, those rows of atoms, you have to tilt the crystal to a perfectly specific angle.
Right, the Bragg angle.
So the Bragg angle has to be just right relative to the electron beam.
You have to line up the shot perfectly. It's like trying to look through a set of blinds from across the room.
Exactly. And that means you can only take measurements from very specific, very small subregions of the austenite that just happen to be oriented correctly. You're selecting a very small biased sample.
You're cherry picking, even if you don't mean to.
Precisely. Whereas the atom probe, is a bulldozer.
Huh.
It just eats through a whole cylinder of material. It takes a core sample. It gives you a statistical average of a much, much larger volume.
So the atom probe sees the climate, but the TEM is seeing the weather.
That is a perfect way to put it. The carbon in the austenite isn't a smooth blended soup. It's lumpy. There are tiny pockets of high carbon and pockets of low carbon.
And the impossible numbers, the ones above the equilibrium line.
Real fluctuations. On the scale of a few nanometers, you know, statistical noise is real life. You can have a tiny cluster of carbon atoms that violates the average just for a moment in a tiny space.
So the TEM wasn't wrong. It was too zoomed in. It was showing us the messy reality of the atomic scale, while the atom probe was giving us the polite, averaged out truth.
Exactly. And because the TEM researchers are human, looking for good pictures, they might have subconsciously picked the clearest, most distinct fringes, which might happen to be the high carbon spots.
So what's the final verdict? What does this all mean for the incomplete reaction theory?
It's a victory for the theory. By proving that strain doesn't invalidate the measurements, the authors basically confirm that the general trend of the data stopping at that T0 curve is correct.
So bainite really does form by shear.
Yes. It grows with a full supersaturation of carbon, just like martensite, and the reaction stops when the austenite hits that T0 energy limit. The fact that the reaction is incomplete is a real physical phenomenon. It's not a measurement error.
And that actually matters for making steel. Right?
Huge. It means you can retain films of austenite between the bainite plates. And that retained austenite is what gives modern high-strength steels their ductility.
Their ability to bend without breaking.
Right. If the reaction went all the way to completion, we wouldn't have those properties.
There was one other nugget in the paper about plastic relaxation. We talked about elastic strain, but they also mentioned plastic strain.
Yes. The Eshelby math showed something interesting. If the metal tried to hold all that stress purely elastically, like a stretching rubber band, the energy required would be enormous.
The metal would snap.
Or the stress levels would be over 1%, which is huge.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the metal survives and the strains in the foil are low tells us it must be relaxing plastically.
Meaning it's permanently deforming.
It's yielding. It's flowing around the new bainite to relieve the pressure. So even though the elastic strain didn't feather the carbon numbers, The stress is absolutely driving the structure of the steel.
It's a dynamic, violent environment down there.
It is.
It's funny. We think of a piece of steel as this cold, static, dead thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you zoom in with these papers and it's just full of drama.
It's never just a piece of metal. It's a frozen conflict.
And I think the lesson here isn't just about steel. It's about data.
How so?
Well, we always want the direct measurement. We trust the atom probe because it counts. We distrust the TEM because it infers. But this paper shows the indirect method was actually telling us something true about the variability, the lumpiness that the direct method smooths over.
That's a great point. If you average everything out, you miss the extremes. And sometimes the extremes are where the interesting physics is happening. The scatter wasn't noise. The scatter was the signal.
One final thought the authors leave us with. They mentioned that even though the strain was small in the foil, in the bulk metal, that stress is very real, and stress affects diffusion.
Right. We usually treat mechanics and thermodynamics as separate subjects, but inside that crystal, they're inextricably linked. A high-stress field can literally squeeze the door shut on atoms trying to move.
So the incomplete reaction might not just be about energy limits. It might be about the metal physically locking itself up.
It's a provocative thought. The squeeze might not fake the data, but it definitely shapes the reality.
Something to mull over next time you look at a car bumper or a skyscraper. You're looking at a billion tiny incomplete reactions, all frozen in time.
And a whole lot of atomic drama.
Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Pleasure as always.
Check your sampling bias, everyone. We'll see you next time.